of comparisons. In terms of baseline risk assessment, C3 can be used to derive concentration response curves for benthos. It can be used to inform food chain modeling and improve ecological and human health risk assessments by a number of different ways. First, we can develop C3-based dose metrics to reduce uncertainty in risk assessment for benthos. We can begin using C3 to estimate bioaccumulation potential and tissue concentrations for comparison to tissue residue effects values, or TRVs. And you can also use these tissues to estimate trophic transfer in food chain models. Now, Carl pointed out a number of caveats, but with appropriate site-specific information, these kinds of exercises can be put into actual practice. We're also thinking that you can improve exposure assessments to help reduce uncertainties associated with human health risk assessment via fish consumption. It can allow for a closer evaluation of sediment contaminants and their proportion within the contaminant pool that is available for uptake by fish. So it really helps out with the uncertainty analysis in human health consumption-based risk assessments. Now this is a figure very similar to what Carl showed earlier to bring out the point of moving toward using pore water concentrations as a dose metric for biological effects. And this graph basically shows a pretty good dose response curve for the 34 PAHs that includes the 16 priority PAHs that most people are used to seeing, as well as a number of alkylated daughter PAHs. The next slide shows what this data looked like when only using total sediment PAH concentrations. And here the PAH concentrations are shown as the priority only, which is the typical way that PAHs are measured and used in toxicity tests. So you can see that between about 10 and 1,000 part per million PAHs in the sediments, it's very difficult to interpret any relationships here because you've got both high and low survival over this large span of concentrations. So there's essentially no relationship. Again, we saw improvements with the pore water measurements and the correlation or the regression of that pore water data against the response data. Now, Carl showed some bioaccumulation data in exposed organisms relative to sediment concentrations or pore water concentrations from laboratory tests with some of the same scientists that were generating those graphs that Carl showed. We've also done some work in the field that showed that there was good correlation between musculoskeletal tissue, a type of muscle, and SPEMI-derived pore water concentrations for PAHs. That's the right graph. We had pretty good R-square values up almost at 0.9. We had a weaker correlation shown with TOC-normalized bulk sediment concentrations in those tissue concentrations. So the point of showing this is because we're generating this data in situ, in this case with the exposure of caged organisms, if we can start to generate these kinds of relationships site-specifically, which is a site-specific calibration of a passive sampling technique, we can begin using these relationships to estimate tissue residues for benthic organisms in areas where we may only collect the pore water data. Again, in the interest of minimizing the destructive sampling that biological samples require and the expense that that also takes with it. If we can develop these techniques for either caged organisms or use suitable indigenous species, we can begin to use these passive sampling techniques in a more predictable fashion. In terms of modeling, PSMs and C3 measurements can also be a source of input parameters for models, whether it's a contaminant mass balance model or a sediment and contaminant transport model, or as we've been discussing and focusing mostly on during these talks, exposure and dose response and bioaccumulation. Also, these data can be used in risk or site recovery projections or in engineering design. And here's just a quick example of the use of C3 in evaluating remedial options when trying to design a cap. So on the right side of this graph, It shows the general calf design for this example, which was a 10-inch thick active activated carbon layer. It was an activated carbon sand mixture of 10 inches thick that was placed above contaminated sediments. And then on top of that, it had a 12-inch thick armor layer, and one could also design either a thin sand layer or a habitat layer on top of that. So a lot of work had to go into coming up with this optimal design for the site, and pore water concentrations were a critical parameter in the model that was used to generate and eventually come to this design. So on the left side of this graph here, there's these pore water concentration profiles that are shown from what's called the CAP-SIM model. It estimates what pore water concentrations within a cap and potential breakthrough times would be over a series of years. And here we're showing from time zero all the way to 250 years after application of a cap. And the pore water concentrations are a critical parameter in this model. And as you can see, even after 250 years, we're not expecting a lot of migration of the contaminant into the active layer of the cap. And therefore, the expectation is that for centuries, this design should be stable. Of course, that needs to be followed up with monitoring. But, you know, these mathematical models that are used in design, if we can get a better pore water concentration as input to these models, we'll have higher confidence and less uncertainty on our eventual designs. Within remedy effectiveness monitoring, the use of C3 can be used to evaluate whether risk reduction objectives have been achieved or are being achieved over time. There are numerous records of decision out there where REOs exist on the variation of reducing bioavailable concentrations of sediment contaminants, whether it's PCBs, metals, or PAHs. So we need a measurement technique to really show that bioavailability within the sediments is decreasing. And measuring the sediment pore water and looking for trends over time, or looking for reduced flux to the surface water with these tools is one way of evaluating achievement of those REOs. Another way we can use these data, and Carl's already shown one of these pore water profiles for a cap, so I'm not going to dwell on this specific graph, but utilizing this type of data in a different way. Here we can look at what happens over time within a cap. And here we've got a graph that shows concentrations that were measured at a given location in the cap in 2009 and then again in 2010. This is for PAHs, and these are at specific locations within the cap. And what you see is when you plot the line here, it's pretty close to 1-to-1, which shows that there's stable concentrations within the cap. In other words, the PAHs aren't leaving the cap. It's doing what it was designed to do, which is sequester contamination. Here's another graph that shows a similar measurement in a different part of the cap. It basically shows that the 2010 concentrations of PAHs were higher than those observed in 2009, which suggests an upward migration of contamination within the cap. Now, this isn't necessarily an alarm, because these concentrations may not be relevant to exposure and risk if they were to actually break through at daylight, but it does give you information to allow calculation of rates of breakthrough and what the potential breakthrough times are to inform any decisions during the operation and maintenance portion of the management of a contaminated sediment site. So again, this information is important because it allows you to see the movement of contaminants within a cap. Whether or not it will pose an additional risk is something that needs to be evaluated and discussed with the risk assessors, and it will also be based on what your PRGs are. I mentioned I was going to return to a few points on using passive sampling methods and C3 measurements as indicators for fish tissue monitoring programs. The combined evidence from passive sampler trend monitoring of surface water and pore water, the latter of which is an indicator of bioaccumulation by sediment-associated biota that may be the prey items of fish, can be used to determine when fish tissue evaluations would be appropriate for assessing whether remedial targets for fish tissue have been achieved or whether fish consumption advisories should be set maintained or relaxed. And what I mean here by when fish tissues should be evaluated, that's when you should actually take samples. You know, there are a number of monitoring programs where sampling is done annually or every 3 years or every 5 years. You know, there are general requirements general recommendations that within a 5-year period, 2 samples should be taken. But by combining those general guidelines with passive sampling information, we'll really get a much better target on when it's going to matter to get that fish tissue concentration. And it might be at a level that statistically you'd want to make more robust based on the predictions from the C3 measurements so that you can really get a high certainty in your evaluation of whether the RAO has been met. You know, some systems can't support large annual sampling efforts, so targeting when the best time to collect the fish during a long-term monitoring period is the idea here. We've also heard from members of the public at a number of sites that they don't like seeing us out there collecting fish every year. And, you know, in most of the areas where we do have annual fish monitoring, it appears that the populations can withstand, you know, a large sampling effort. But still, it's a good way for us to kind of balance those public pressures, those resource constraints, and the actual need for that tissue data with our understanding of the changing bioavailability in the environment. I've already mentioned that the sampling approach can also reduce the need for regular and destructive sampling of live indigenous organisms and the cost savings that can be achieved through a combined application of PSMs with your biological monitoring program. And I've got a couple of slides here that just point to some of the advantages that passive sampling methods and C3 measurements can provide us. It can also allow us to measure C3 gradients, and this has great environmental and field relevance. Because in situ or field measurements using passive samplers can yield time-integrated concentrations, these devices can be useful for measuring gradients of C3 through the vertical profile of the sediment, or at the sediment-water interface, or between the sediment and overlying water column, or all three of those if you want them all. And this can give us greater insights into the direction and magnitude of the diffusive flux of contaminants, thus improving our conceptual site model and our risk estimates. Second, C3 reduces uncertainty in characterizing contaminant transport, risk assessment, and subsequent risk management decisions, because we're gaining an increased understanding of bioavailable chemical concentrations. PSMs and measurement of C3 can provide for improved accuracy in how we represent the exposure point concentration in sediments, pore water, and surface water that are often used to characterize risk. And the exposure point concentration is often one of those points in a baseline risk assessment where we have a lot of discussion and dialogue and potentially some differences of opinion on how that should be achieved. This offers us another tool that really gets at what the bioavailable concentrations are and therefore should provide more certainty in our EPCs. PSMs are a simpler, less disruptive sampling approach than conventional pore water collection and measurement techniques. And as Carl pointed out, some of these techniques can also provide misleading information due to the artifactual nature and the artifacts that are introduced into your measurement due to the sampling technique itself. Now, some passive samplers, such as solid phase microextraction fibers or SPEMIs, can be configured for direct injection into analytical instruments. This combines sampling and contaminant isolation in one step. And again, this can help us decrease the sample prep time and minimizing the use of extraction solvents. So this is also good for time and cost savings and providing useful information. But overall, the bottom line consensus from the workshop was that improvements from using passive samplers to get at and measure the C3 concentrations and the data collection will provide us with increased certainty. And we've covered all of the concepts and all of the types of applications that are outlined on this slide, so I'm not going to read all of these bullets to you here. And I'd like to thank you very much for listening to Carl and myself, and I think we have some time for questions.
Yes, Thank you very much, Mark. That was excellent. So nice to have a good overview of the workshop and the take-home messages. So thanks very much. We know you're on a time limitation, so maybe I could ask you a couple quick questions, and then
yeah,
I've actually
gotten freed up, so I'm good for another half an hour.
Oh, you are? Okay, excellent. Thank you. Well, several questions have come in, and they keep coming in, but why don't we start with questions from Susan Driscoll. This was to Carl. She wanted to know the purpose of TUs, or the purpose of TUs is to predict samples that are not toxic. And she's referring to slide 10. So maybe if we could cue up Carl's slide number 10. Is that possible? Okay, great. They're working on that. So the question was, depending on whether you want to optimize your benchmark to predict samples that are not toxic or to predict samples that are toxic, they're just making a comment that there may be an overlap between those two outcomes.
Yeah, and this is Carl. I appreciate that, and you know, certainly what the graph presents is toxic units based on the final chronic value, which that value is intended to be protective of aquatic organisms. So that's going to be more protective or lower than the value where you actually see. Why don't you go down one more? Why don't you go to slide 11, if you could. The value, so that value is going to be, the final chronic value is going to be more protective or lower than, or more conservative than you actually see the effects. And that's shown here where you can see, as I mentioned, that's the final chronic value, and the data that are being expressed here are the acute concentrations. So depending on what you want to portray at your site, what you want to manage, what endpoint you want to manage around, you could either use an acute value or the final chronic value, recognizing that the final chronic value is sort of a indicator of where things can start to go for the range of aquatic organisms, while the acute value is actually empirical for what you're seeing there, recognizing, of course, that laboratory toxins can be different than environmental or what you would see in the environment. So we have to keep those sort of limitations in mind. But I think that regardless, you know, this is a tool, is a nice way of actually demonstrating the exposures out there that can drive effects, whether it's acute or chronic, you know, whatever endpoint you want to manage around. Hopefully that helps to at least address or frame that question.
Thanks. Another, just a follow-on question about slide 13. This is about Raoult's law. So again, the comment was from Susan. I thought Raoult's law would result in greater solubility and therefore lower KOW than the actual KOW predictions.
Yeah, I'd have to point Susan back to Steve's original paper, you know, on that discussion. I think what's important here is just that the empirically derived KOCs, so Justin, it's two slides down, slide 13. The empirically derived KOCs are a lot, the empirically derived KOCs, which are the black dots that we see there, are a lot higher than what you would typically see from using equilibrium partitioning using log KOW. I'm not quite sure on the specifics of the Raoult's law. I'd refer Susan and other folks interested in that to Dr. Hawthorne's paper. But really what this is pointing out is it's higher than we typically see from what we'd expect from equilibrium partitioning theory, and there's a wide variation from these different sediments, which gets back to Steve's primary point, which is you got to go out and measure it. You just can't go into it with an estimate.
Great. So moving on, slide 17, I believe we start to talk about equilibrium sampler. So a question came in from Brewster Conant. Depending on the size of the equilibrium sampler, Isn't it the same as the depletive? Or is the depletive better than, or is the depletive better explained as a sink that cannot come to equilibrium and keep sucking in contaminants and getting more concentrated with time?
Yeah, I think that you hit it. You're right. It can't. It's intended to completely eliminate. You know, the partitioning is such that it's intended to completely eliminate all the measurable concentrations from the water. Suck it all up so that you can say effectively how many nanograms of contaminant were within that volume of water. While the equilibrium is not intended to deplete the area. The sample or the area right around the sample. So they are different. And the depletive sampling there's an ASTM method around that, and it's actually intended more or less as an extraction method. What they're doing there is they're isolating pore water, they're removing the colloids through a flocculation procedure, and then what's left is the freely dissolved contaminants. They put a steamy fiber in there, and it basically sucks every last dissolved contaminant onto that within the frame, within the constraints of equilibrium partitioning, but it's effectively every last contaminant, and then they put that through the GC to measure exactly how many, the mass of contaminant per that volume of water, which is different here than the equilibrium sampling, which can be done in either in the environment or in vessels in the laboratory.
Great, and kind of continuing on, David Langseth asks, whether depletive sampling can be considered a special case with an extremely high partition coefficient material rather than a separate category of sampling. And then maybe I'll go on and ask his other question. Can depletive sample, when using high partition coefficient sampling material, can you create a situation in which the ambient conditions are altered so much by the introduction of the adsorptive sampling material that it gives a falsely high reading due to its own absorption of the chemicals and consequent desorption from the sediments to maintain the equilibrium between the sediments and pore water?
That's a great question, and the folks that have the folks that are going to be available in the subsequent presentations would be actually the best to get into it, folks like Upal, who have gotten into a lot greater detail on that. But it's the idea that, for instance, when you take these things into the laboratory and you take your, 1 centimeter square palm coupon and roll it around in the sediments for a period of time, that you're not actually going to be depleting the sediments to such an extent that the equilibrium equilibrium partitioning would be altered. So there is a concern, as you mentioned, at least a hypothetical concern, that if you put in a really, really strongly something with a very large K passive sampler into the sediment, that it could cause local depletion. But it's the idea that when done in the laboratory, you're constantly moving these sediments around, and out in the field, that you have a small enough mass of passive sampler compared to your mass of sediments and mass of contaminant, that you're not really going to be causing that sort of local depletion. So that's the concept, at least. But these are great questions, and I think that one in particular could be brought up again to the folks like Upal Ghosh and who've done.
Okay, yeah, that's a good point, and I would encourage anyone on the line to tune into the subsequent seminars as well. David Langseth did follow up, and I mean, it sounds like what you're describing is an in situ, the depletive sampler is used in situ. He asked, if so, how do you define the affected water volume?
Yeah, well, the depletive sampler isn't in situ, and thank you for clarifying that. If you can go up one sample, Justin, I think.
Slide 16, maybe?
Yeah, 16. One more down. One more down to 16. No, that was up. Okay, I'm sorry. Keep going down. 18. Okay, there we are. So basically on the left-hand side, what we're looking at is like the mil and a half of isolated pore water. That isolated pore water would undergo this flocculation procedure to get rid of any of this sort of colloid-associated contaminants So then you just have your freely dissolved contaminants in there. So it's not in situ, it's laboratory. So Dr. Hawthorne performs these types of analyses, as do other labs. You actually send them the sediments. He takes out pulls out some of the sediments, isolates the pore water, goes through this flocculation procedure, and then inserts the SPEMI into it, or the POM into it, depending on the process being used, but the ASTM method is for the SPEMI. All the contaminants sorb onto that SPEMI, and then you're able to use your mass on your SPEMI over the volume that was actually extracted. So this depletive sampling is different than the in situ than the equilibrium sampling, and it's actually just an extraction procedure. It's not a whole lot different than if you mix in hexane with methylene chloride into it and mix it around and continue to decant that off. It's just that this is a solid phase extraction instead of a liquid extraction.
Great, and we have a few more questions about your talk directly, a couple more that came in for Mark's talk directly, and then some kind of overall talk. So we want to try to get through as many as we can. There was a few questions that came in about the monitoring of the cap over time, and that might go to slide 23 for reference. This was from Brewster Conant. He said, could you comment on the monitoring in the cap over time? Given spatial variability, if you do not exactly measure in the same location, temporal variability can be confused with spatial variability. How is that accounted for in the study? So that was from Brewster Conant. And then I just want to also, Jay Gann asked what material was used in the isolation cap. And we also heard from... Is that enough for right now?
Well, yeah, I can hit the last one easily. In the in the sand and gravel layer, it was an organoclay mix. In the sand and in the sand layer that was just above the contaminated sediments, it was an organoclay mix, organoclay and sand in there, which was covered by a gravel layer. The other one regarding temporal and spatial variability. You nailed it on the head, and that's exactly right, and that's one of the things that you need to really constrain that. One of the lessons learned for us, what we found as we went into this is that our cap had variability in how it was constructed, and that could confound these. I mean, if you're not exactly where you were the prior sample, you can have that issue. There are good improvements in GPS that will get you, close. That'll get you very close. Another thing you might want to consider is, if your site allows it, is some sort of marker that you can place in the environment and go back to repeatedly. It's a lot harder to do if you're, 30 or 40 feet underwater. But in this type of environment, and a lot of the sediment, contaminated sediment environments we work in, that's not something that would be impossible. That's a great question and a great comment. You need to at least recognize that as an uncertainty, hopefully do some work to eliminate that as a confounding factor.
Oh, great. And Jennifer Suter asks another angle from the same slide. How can you differentiate between recontamination and dissolved contaminants moving through a low OC cap and accumulating in higher OC sediment depositing on top of the cap?
Because these samplers are out there over the course of 21 to 28 days, they would presumably, if there was contaminated pore water that was migrating past them, for instance, in that example that she suggested, they would sorb into the passive sampler, and they would be detected. There is a possibility, I guess, that process was not occurring during the time that you had your deployment, but there are many possibilities, but for a lot of things. But the idea is that your passive sampler is out there for long enough that it would pick up that. And if you really think that is a potential, then you should change your sampling time frame to encounter the most likelihood of that, or increase your sampling frequency. But that's a good question. Thank you.
I thought it was a good question too. Well done, Jennifer. Susan asks about slide 27. She said, I think that you need to make the point that passive samplers are supposed to be able to capture a reasonable maximum BSAF so long as you are measuring the sediment concentration to which the organism is actually exposed. Critters can always accumulate less on the basis of their behavior, feeding mode, avoidance, I think is common. Of course, this is good to point out that you can underestimate BSAF if the sediment concentration measured is an underestimate of what the organism is exposed to. For example, you measure the concentration in the top 5 centimeters, but the organism only feeds in the top centimeter. So without further explanation, the discussion on this slide is discouraging to potential users.
Yeah, I think that, and I understand that there certainly are pitfalls associated with with using organisms as well. And I think that those have been, that Susan describes those and summarizes those. But, what we're getting at here is that organisms feed differently. They can have different exposures. If your management objective is to protect or to lessen those exposures to organisms, we have to be thoughtful about what organisms do we mean, and are we going to hold those up as being some sort of gold standard, and do we want to, and can we represent those using passive samplers? It's the concept that the organisms have variability, their feeding strategies cause variability, and that it's not as simple as when you initially approach it, can be thought of that, a freely dissolved concentration is going to define it for everything in the same way. But there are complexities associated with organism bioaccumulation sampling, and those can manifest some of these differences as well.
Great. So there's some broader questions that have come in that kind of overall talk about results from passive samplers. When do you use them? What is the cost? A lot of practical questions. And I would encourage Mark to jump in for these questions, even though they came in during the time that Carl was speaking. These are probably crossover both discussions. So let's start with Robert Noon's question. How do sample results from passive samplers compare with results from pore water sampling by conventional sampling and analytical methods? Has any side-by-side testing been done? And again, this question came in to Carl, but if Carl, you can take a first stab at it, or Mark, or...
Okay, well, yeah, I
go ahead, Carl.
My answer will be easy. I don't have that in front of me, about those particulars. I do know that when you when you do whole water sampling, you pick up a lot of materials that aren't picked up by the passive water sampling. I think that would be something that could be defined through the literature, though. Mark, perhaps you have further insight.
No specific citations, but just from experience and knowledge of the literature, the centrifugation techniques, which are commonly applied, can lead to some misleadingly high results in some cases, especially if you're not flocculating out or filtering appropriately to minimize colloid-associated organic contaminant masses into your concentration term.
Yeah, and actually, thinking back on it, I actually have a citation on that, that where I had put SPMDs into groundwater. It's actually in the S&T, and the order there were very large differences between whole water sample concentrations and those seen from the passive samplers. I don't have the sort of order of magnitude on my on the top of my head though.
The other consideration. I'm sorry, Carl. Were you done?
No. Go ahead.
The other consideration that goes along with, when you're thinking about using passive samplers versus one of the more common techniques, whether it's suction or centrifugation, getting the sample, getting enough pore water to provide a measurement, whether it's meaningful or not, sometimes can become a huge challenge and can really cause a lot of resource expenditure for not a lot of samples. So providing another technique where you have a lot more control over spatial coverage at the site or the ability to get a meaningful sample off of multiple samples that are taken back into a laboratory, you know, that's one of those additional advantages other than our understanding that you get a more accurate descriptor of the bioavailable concentration in the pore water itself, or the surface water for that matter, but we're really focused more on the pore water here.
Great. I think that's a great way to summarize, you know, some of the advantages and limitations thereof. I have a couple more, you know, along those lines. Luis Rivera says this very interesting talk. Wanted to know what depths are interstitial water, as in pore water, considered influential in the bioavailability of contaminants? And then Dev Morali did ask specifically about relative cost for practical implementation of passive sampling devices. So really, what depths are you talking about? And any comments about practical issue of cost?
Go ahead, Mark.
Well, this is the magic question in sediment management, is not only what depth do we care about, but what's the biologically relevant or the bioactive zone within the sediments that we're going to base a decision on. Now, you can make measurements of pore water contaminants. You know, I've seen measurements that go beneath the meter. Whether or not it's relevant is the difficult question. When you combine the information that we have from biological sampling in the sediments to know where the organisms occur, with flux of or advective flux of water within the sediments, whether it's lateral or whether it's horizontal, so the upwelling or the downwelling conditions of interstitial water, and then combine that with the chemical activity measurements you get from passive samplers, you need to weigh all those lines of evidence or combine all those lines of evidence to answer that question of what's the relevant depth here. You know, in typical practice, the relevant depth is usually somewhere around a foot, plus or minus. But that's a very general statement there, and it can vary from site to site. And we would encourage you to look at those multiple lines of evidence to make that decision at your site.
That's a great point, multiple lines of evidence. I'm going to jump to, Mark, a question that came up about one of your slides in particular because it follows on about the spatial resolution. This is slide 11 from Mark's presentation. From Deborah Williston, she asked what spatial resolution and what SPMs be placed to define the site boundaries.
Well, again, that's a very difficult question to answer quickly, and it would really depend upon how large of an area are you willing to miss on your site. Whether you're after looking at the spatial variability on a meter scale or larger, or whether you're thinking on the operational scale, if I'm going to take an action at this site, What is the minimal operational scale over which I'd make a decision? That could be, you know, on the order of an acre or a fraction of an acre. If you have strictly biological questions that are driving your investigation, your spatial scale might be on the order of meters or hundreds of meters. It's very difficult to give you a cut and dry answer to that question. Another consideration is, are you looking to see what your variability across the sediment is, or are you more interested in getting an average value for the area over which you need to make the measurement? Again, this has to do with balancing the remedial action operational size relative to the biologically relevant scale of your question.
Well, that's great. And here's a from Susan Driscoll on the very next slide, slide 12, had a question kind of operationally. What if you were to dig out the area of high activity, then contaminant from the area of high concentration redistributes to the area of high activity so that the activity of the system is unchanged? She said, I guess all of our remediation approaches have to consider sediment stability.
I would absolutely agree with that statement.
And then on slide 13, Susan continues. She says, your comments on slide 13 seem to imply that exposure was only from pore water rather than as a measure of activity from the whole sediment, though I understand that the major point of your slide was to encourage use of LOE, which I agree is a good idea.
Yeah, in the screening level assessment, typically we only have abiotic data, so data on sediments or water. So the point here is that the assumption is that pore water is more relevant than just total bulk sediment. So including pore water into the screening level assessment by, in this case, comparing it to a water quality criterion, which is typically a surface water, ambient water quality criterion, would be as effective or potentially more effective in the power to inform your next decision in the risk assessment than just relying on bulk sediment concentrations.
Okay, and so maybe you can help us with Ernest Ashley's question. He follows and says, it seems the effectiveness of PSMs to predict reductions in bioavailability and biouptake is well established. So can you speak whether benthic uptake monitoring is warranted? The fish travel too widely to be a good metric of progress.
That's a really good question, and I think it's trying to tie together a number of points that I was attempting to make in this talk. I think there is a consensus that passive sampling methods can allow you to better track bioavailability in a given space, so in a given location of the sediment. And if you have enough of those locations in the sediment, you can get an overall feel for how the environment is responding and recovering from an action. So I think there's a place for biological monitoring, not only during assessment, but also during the long-term monitoring after an action's been taken. But the frequency at which you take those biological samples could potentially be reduced by the increased use of passive samplers so that you can better track what's happening with bioavailability and use that to help you pinpoint in time when it would be a good time to take a biological sample, because biological sampling provides a lot of comfort to the public as well as to regulators who have routinely for decades now been relying on tissue information as the basis of decisions. And not only that point, but also many of the records of decision, at least within the Superfund program, have some kind of a tissue goal associated with at least adult fish for human health consumption. And occasionally you'll get some ecologically based tissue concentrations that are targets within a remedial action. And I think that the point about how fish swim and move around is an excellent point that helps to support, if we know we've got a reduction in bioavailability within a sediment environment, we're going to have a much better chance of detecting a change in the fish as well, because they integrate over such large areas.
Okay, thank you. Kathy Krebs makes a comment. I've had clients wonder how to convert from the concentration on PSM to the concentration in the water column. Carl said this can be found in the literature. Can you provide more hints on to where to get this specifically for SPME? And we do have a way to post this or send that directly to Kathy if either between Carl and Mark don't have it off the top of your head. But
So the series of papers that I mentioned that are in Integrated Environmental Assessment and Management, you can easily find the one that I showed because there's a link for it in the slides. But in the exact same issue of that journal, there are five other papers associated with passive sampling. and one of them that focuses on practical guidance and another one that focuses on the scientific underpinnings of passive sampling have a lot of those equations and techniques described. And if you need more detail, the citations within those two specific papers provide even more information.
Okay, great. So that clarifies that. Another clarifying question from Jay Gann. Pore water concentration and C-free have been used interchangeably by the speakers. They are not really the same. Pore water may have DOM, and pore water concentration is greater than C-free. Theoretically, only C-free should be used. Clarify.
Point taken. What we're focusing on, Carl, if I'm misspeaking for you, jump in. But what we're focusing on with these two talks and with the subsequent talks in coming months is the C-free concentration term. So that which we understand to be freely dissolved in the pore water.
Yeah, that's right, Mark. And I thought I prefaced it by when we're talking about the concentrations derived from these passive samplers. It's the freely dissolved component or the C-free. So that's to clarify when we're discussing this, it's the freely dissolved.
Jay's point is right though in that at least I know I used the term pore water a number of times during my talk, and my meaning was the C-free term. So thanks for that clarification point.
Great. Let's go on to another question. This came from Ken Finkelstein. Carl said that the passive sampler can be used in place of EQP, which I assume equilibrium partitioning is what's meant by that. But the PS competes with the EQP equation by calculating the pore water. Therefore, the local KOC is known and can be used in locations at the same site that is nearby to determine if the sediment concentrations are a risk or not. Does that sound right?
From what I understood, Ken was saying that the sediment concentration, or at least the contaminant concentration on the organic fraction, can be used in combination with the C-free or the freely dissolved pore water contaminant concentration to derive a local KOC. And I'd agree with that, and that local KOC can fit, does fit directly into equilibrium partitioning theory. One of the earlier simplifying assumptions was that the KOC was equivalent to KOW, and that can be the case in certain sediment situations, but I think that oftentimes at our contaminated sediment sites, that's not the case, and we saw that in the various empirical studies that were presented in both of our talks.
Here's another question about conversions and calculations. This is from Wilmer Reyes. How do pore water measurements compare with AVS SEM measurements? So by that, AVS meaning acid volatile sulfide, SEM meaning simultaneously extracted metal. Is one method more precise than the other one? Do you need to measure both for remedial decisions?
Hey, Carl, you mind if I take this one?
Please do.
So some of the future talks are going to describe where the science is with regard to passive samplers for metals, and they're not quite as advanced as where we are with organic contaminants. So AVS and SEM measurements are still highly useful to at least within the eyes of the workshop participants. More work needs to be done on the side of metals, but there has been some progress made. So at this point in time, I don't think we're ready to discuss the advantages of metals passive sampling to the degree that we are organic contaminants. That's a really good question, and hopefully it will motivate more folks to be working in this field and move that science on metals forward.
Right, and thank you very much for queuing up, the fact that we will be discussing metals on December 1st, metals and passive sampling devices. While we're talking about other contaminants that can be, and several people asked about metals, so that'll be discussed a little bit on December 1st. So I hope those people can tune in for that. And if not, there will be an archive of the session from December 1st about metals. Erica Hoffman did ask also, in addition to metals, organometals like TBT, tributyl tin. Have there been passive samplers used for that? And this is if either of you know.
Yeah, I don't. I'm not aware of any right now. It wouldn't surprise me. I think that perhaps Mark knows, or I'm certain many of the other speakers within this forum would know.
Okay, and also Erica also asked about PC pentachlorophenol, saying that in Region 10 they've had difficulty measuring PCP in poor water using SPMEs, and wonder if there's maybe other examples she might turn to.
Well, there are numerous other kinds of passive sampling techniques, and we've applied some of them out in Region 10 for volatiles in sediments and in pore water. Those are just typical diffusion samplers or peeper-type samplers. The problem with those methods is that you require a large peeper vial volume to get a meaningful result, and they're typically on the you know, there's a concentration by volume type of result, so it's not a direct concentration value that's generated from those. There was a, I can provide the citation to Heather after the seminar, but there was a paper that was authored by Bruce Duncan and a number of others that was published in Integrated Environmental Science and Assessment back in 2007 and described some of those techniques. But the point about the SPME fiber or the POM or whatever plastic we're talking about, it's not going to suit every kind of contaminant, is well taken. And, you know, therefore, it's important to kind of remind ourselves that we're working within the context of passive samplers. But we've really focused in for the seminar series on organic contaminants like PCBs, PAHs, dioxins, highly hydrophobic contaminants, and metals. So thanks for the question.
Yeah. Great. And Tim Mower asked again about the date for metals, which is December 1st, and wanted to know about mercury, and I do believe that will be discussed. Mercury is one of the metals discussed. So while we're on slide 13, Tim Thompson asked or wanted to make the comment that the slide is perhaps a little bit misleading. The slide discusses poor water as the primary exposure pathway. He says that is not what pore water measures are used for. Equilibrium partitioning states that there is equilibrium between the sediment-bound HOCs with benthic fauna, in fauna, and pore water. To solely list pore water measure as the exposure medium is not accurate. The organisms will come into equilibrium at the same order of magnitude as the pore water measure.
Yeah, it's Mark. I don't disagree at all with Tim. However, in the screening context of an ecological risk assessment, you're often only presented with abiotic data again. So the assumption is that the pore water is the primary exposure medium relative to sediment or surface water. But his point is well taken in the baseline risk assessment construct.
We did get a question from Charles Maurice. Why is the sea-free preferred over the pore water, i.e. some biota take in minute particles as well as the solely liquid portion? I would think you'd prefer to eliminate the particulate component.
Hey, Carl, I don't have any problem with that comment. Again, there's always multiple lines of evidence that are used in risk assessment. But typically, a lot of our site assessments and decisions are based on direct tox to benthos, at least on the ecological assessments are. And it is that freely dissolved concentration that seems to be the most useful data input to making those evaluations. But for filter feeders, for a lot of mussel species, you know, Chuck's got a very good point.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that the contaminant concentration in an organism is a function of both pore water and its diet, or you know, whether that's through incidental consumption or purposeful. So.
Let's see. So we did get a question from Trudy Watson Long. She asks, aren't water quality benchmarks usually based on water-only toxicity testing in the laboratory? Is there any concern that the sensitivity of sediment-dwelling organisms are less frequently included in water-only assessments?
That's a great question. And in fact, that question was, I believe, addressed in Dr. DeToro's 1991 paper, or at least he looked at the sensitivity of sediment-dwelling organisms in conjunction with others. I think that it's still, or in conjunction with water column-dwelling organisms. That question is still oftentimes brought up, and I think that it's probably still undergoing some level of definition, but the that question was addressed directly by Dr. Toro in that paper, and I believe again in EPA's PAHESB PAHESB guidelines that came out in 2013.
Okay, great. That's certainly helpful to know where to go for the answer there. Christine Brown asked, there was mention, sorry. I think we'll get back to Christine Brown on her question. She again asked about journal citations, but we'll get back to her on that. Brewster Conant also wanted to ask Mark about slide 9, revisiting an early question. You mentioned the concept of a decision unit scale, which addresses spatial scale of sampling horizontally for impacts on organisms. Is that term defined by EPA, and is there specific guidance on defining that scale?
Short answer, no. It's very site-specifically determined by the project team and by the conversations between the agency and the regulated party or parties.
Okay. A lot of questions about scale. Understandable.
The hard part is that, you know, there's really no good manual for how the site small d and big D decisions are made. And a lot of it comes through the use of information that has a high certainty associated with it, or at least that's what we strive for. And so that's the point of bringing this seminar series to bear, is that we've got some new methodologies that we have some higher confidence in, that we hope that when they're considered can increase the certainty that we have for data to make decisions. And maybe we'll get to those decisions a little bit more quickly and with a little less a conversation and argument.
Okay, so I had another question from Brett Thomas. For non-depletive sampling, such as the PSDs in the field, how do you estimate concentration of contaminant in the pore water from what is collected on the PSD? How can you tell how much water you have sampled? I think that one's also been covered, but if there's anything else you wanted to add to that. Mark, did you answer that question?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
And I have some bad news in that I'm 15 minutes late for my 2:30 meeting.
Okay.
And
we have run over, and thank you so much, Mark, for your time. And, of course, if there are other questions that have not been answered, we'll make sure that you have a chance to answer those questions, and certainly appreciate your time. Carl, how was your time? Should we?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Heather, for putting this together and for everybody who attended today. Really, thank you very much for your attention. And
Thanks for your time.
To answer any of the remaining questions through email. So thank you.
Okay.
My time's okay. I would say to answer that question, I think that we did address it in at least in part in a couple different places. I think that it's a great question. I think that it's oftentimes derived from sort of the literature K passive sampler values, but it's more thoroughly defined through the more recently through the use of performance reference compounds. When I can just say that to key up a number of the presentations that are going to come within the for the next speakers, where they really get into more thoroughly how those performance reference compounds are used to quantify the C-free in the sediment pore water.
Thank you, and maybe this is a good time to just draw the line and say, okay, unanswered questions. We'll give both Carl and Mark an opportunity to look at the questions that have come through. A lot of them are similar to questions that have been asked already, but we will certainly let Carl and Mark look at each question so that they can provide any nuances to your specific question. And we certainly We certainly appreciate all of the questions that have come through. Excellent food for thought. As you can tell, there are a lot that we're still trying to work out about pore water sampling and how we can use passive sampling devices. And so we certainly encourage continuation of this discussion by tuning in to our upcoming webinars. Again, these are free and available to the public. Session 2 will be on passive sampling devices for organic contaminants on November 19th. Session 3 will be about metals. Again, we talked about that's December 1st. And then our fourth and final session will be on case studies for organic contaminants, and that will be on December 15th. All of that information is available in the links, the related URLs page. So do you have some closing announcements? Let's see. Again, there's the link to seminar resources, and I just again want to let you know about the seminar feedback. We certainly appreciate your feedback and encourage you to let us know if you have any ideas or questions or how we can improve the webinar. I'm going to see if there's anything else that I need to say. I certainly wanted to thank Carl and Mark for their excellent presentations today. Certainly getting us starting to think about pore water and how we can sample it and how we can use it for contaminant sediment monitoring. Again, I really want to give credit to Matt Lambert from the US EPA OSRTI, who was certainly a large part of organizing the NARPM session that happened this summer. We had a number of other people involved in the course development team: Helen Botcher, Jim Honenberg, Clint Sperry, Mike Adam, Gary Turner, Gene Ballant, Justin Crane, Austin Oschlanger were also very much involved. And we look forward to our upcoming speakers. Next will be Rob Burgess, Upal Ghosh, and Keith Maruria. Again, talking about organic contaminants. Taking on the metals question will be Mark Cantwell and Chris Eckley. And then telling us a little bit about case studies that have happened on December 15th, we'll hear from Judy Wong and Rochelle Thompson. And again, I just want to thank Carl and Mark for today's presentation. Definitely food for thought, and I'm looking forward to continuing this discussion for the next webinar. And again, questions that have come through, we will certainly have our questions that have come through that have not been answered. We'll make sure to have our presenters follow up with the people who asked the question. And again, you will get an archive of this webinar when it's available. You will get an email ping, so you will know how to access the webinar. Carl and Mark's emails were also available with the information associated with the webinar. So that's another way that if you had follow-up questions, you could certainly contact the presenters directly. So again, I want to thank you. Thank you for coming to today's webinar. Thank again Carl Gustafson, Mark Greenberg, and behind the scenes, Gene Ballant and Justin Crane. Couldn't do it without them. At this point, I would like to conclude today's presentation and want to thank you very much for your participation. Goodbye, everybody.